This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. My guest this week is Michael Broun, Executive Director of the Sierra Club, and author of Coming Clean, Breaking America's Addiction to Oil and Coal. Rolling Stone magazine just named him one of the new green heroes. Michael Broun, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Matt, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to meet you. I read about you, and I've been a fan of the Sierra Club for a long time. And I saw your picture when you got arrested February of 2013 here, so I want to talk about that too. What was that like?
Well, you know, getting arrested in front of the White House, it was a bit of a spectacle. There was, you know, a bank of cameras larger than what I've ever seen in anything I've done for 20 years on environmental issues. I think part of it was because of the fact that the president had just given his State of the Union speech. Clearly, the Keystone XL pipeline fight has become a very high profile, perhaps the most high-profile environmental fight. And then also what we didn't realize afterwards is what a celebrity and tabloid star Connor Kennedy is, who's the son of Bobby Kennedy Jr., who also was dating Taylor Swift. And so there's a fair amount of cameras there from TMZ and the like. And so it was a bit of a circus for a lot of reasons.
Oh, I didn't realize that little pop sensation was going on too. I mean, I saw you there with Bill McKibben and Julian Bond. Those are people I recognize.
Yeah, well, for me, it was a great honor because I was standing right between Julian Bond and Bill McKibben, and Bill has become a great friend over the years, and I think he's one of the heroes in our climate movement these days. And just to be next to Julian Bond and to talk with him about his history and what he's done at the NAACP, and he was sharing stories with me of the first time he engaged in civil disobedience, working to desegregate a lunch counter at his school down in Georgia. It was really inspiring. And
He's inspiring. I remember as a young, political, geeky teenager seeing him nominated for president, I think, at the 68 convention or one of those. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, he's a cool customer, too. You sometimes meet folks who have a very high profile or have done great things in their lives, and when you have a personal interaction with them, sometimes you know they've maybe lost a little bit of humility.
They're a bit full of themselves.
Yeah, yeah, they believe a lot of the articles that are written about them. But you know, spending a few hours locked to a fence with Julian Bond was inspiring. He's a great man who's done fantastic things in his life, and when you talk to him, he's very human and. I learned a lot from him.
Yeah, he's been doing good work at the NAACP, too. And Bill McKibben isn't full of himself either. That's the nice thing about Bill McKibben.
It's true. It's true. He's almost like the anti-hero of the environmental movement. He's a very humble guy, very serious, but he's a good guy to spend some time with. And I think that what he's done as a writer and with 350, having Bill on our side is one of the things that gives me hope.
Yeah, and I like his style of speaking. Actually, you remind me of his style a little bit here in conversation. I haven't seen you give a barn-burning speech, but I saw Bill, who was at something we call Fighting Bob Fest here in Wisconsin, where an annual gathering with 5,000 to 10,000 progressives every September. And Bill was there, and he had the unenvious task of coming on real late. So people had heard 12 or 15 speakers by then, and it was late in the afternoon, and a lot of people, you know, are speaking real loud, screaming into the microphone, and he gets up and just speaks really quietly,
right,
like this, very sensibly, soberly, and just talking to people like you're sitting right next to him. And I just thought it was wonderful. You know, I just thought it was a great tale. He wasn't trying to imitate some famous orator, and you know, because some people try to do that too.
It was a
very wise thing. And I'm not sure it was a tactical choice. I just think that's who he was. But even if it was a tactical choice, it was a wise one. So, he's done wonderful work too. Let me just ask you, this is the first time I've ever met you, so I'm curious about you. And you grew up in New Jersey. Yeah. That's not the first place you think of as someone becoming an environmentalist out of New Jersey necessarily. So tell me what that was about.
Well, no, I would say New Jersey is a bit of a breeding colony for good environmentalists. So I grew up on the Jersey Shore, and I grew up on a little barrier island, central New Jersey, tiny town, 4 blocks long, called Chadwick Beach. And my father was the mayor of the larger town, Toms River, New Jersey. And so when I was growing up, beautiful place to grow up, but in New Jersey in the 80s, there were these horrific water pollution problems. Two main sources. One is that the town of, or off the coast of New Jersey, hospitals were allowed to dump all of their hospital wastes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just raw chemical waste or raw hospital waste. But then the other source of pollution was this chemical factory that operated just outside of town in Toms River. And they were allowed to dump their untreated wastes. There's a massive pipeline going from the town underneath, or going from the factory underneath the town, dumping it in the ocean. They were the only company to have a permit to dump their untreated waste into the ocean. Millions of gallons of this waste every day. And so growing up, the pollution got worse and worse and worse over time. And so sometimes the hospital waste would come washed up on shore and there'd be hypodermic needles on the beach. And then other days, the chemical waste, the currents would be such that you'd come out and you'd have a rash, or you'd have, you know, these sores or whatever. And so I got inspired because there were a couple environmental groups. Greenpeace came in, a bunch of local groups got involved to raise the awareness about the issue. They started knocking on doors, holding rallies on the beach, conducting these town hearings, and they won. Hospital waste dumping was banned. The chemical company closed their factory. And I got an early lesson, very early lesson, that activism works.
Activism works. That's a great lesson for all of us to have. I'm speaking with Michael Bruhn. He's executive director of the Sierra Club. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine, and you're listening to Progressive Radio. You got involved working with Greenpeace. What were you doing for them?
I did. So I got my start at the very bottom rung of the environmental movement. After graduating from school, I started working for Greenpeace as a canvasser out of Philadelphia. And it was a great job. I loved it. It was a crazy job at the same time. So, you know, knocking on people's doors, talking to strangers, complete strangers, about environmental issues while they're having their dinner or playing with their kids, really gave a glimpse into how people think about environmental issues, what they care about, what they don't care about. And it taught me a lot about movement building and the power of grassroots organizing. So
I was a canvasser once for a group called Massachusetts Fair Share out of Boston.
Yeah.
I went with the clipboard and knocked on those doors and talked to people. You know, you have about 20 seconds.
Right.
To at least before the door slams in your face.
Yeah.
And it's a good setup. Did you do any of those Greenpeace, I'm out on a boat chasing a ship kind
of
deal?
I did do a fair amount of that.
What was that like?
It was great. You know, sometimes you did feel like you were part of a movie. Sometimes you felt like you were part of a really bad movie. But it was always exciting to be able to confront some of the biggest polluters in the world and to do it from a place of practical, pragmatic idealism. You know, to go up there and say, you know, here's the ecological imperative. Here's what the world needs from you. And here's the gap between what you're doing and what you should be doing.
What was the most harrowing experience you had in one of those confrontations?
So this was, I guess, maybe 95, give or take a year or so. We did, the jargon is we did an action. We did an action with Greenpeace up in Seattle. And it was to stop these massive factory trawlers, which would leave Seattle and go up to the North Pacific. And these boats were just strip mining the oceans. They'd have these massive nets. And in one of the most productive and actually biodiverse fisheries in the Northern Hemisphere, they were really causing a great amount of damage. And so what we did is we had a team of divers go in the night before the season opened. A team of divers went in and we basically chained the boat, the propellers of the boat, and we prevented the boat from actually starting up. And then we had another team of folks go in the water and form a human barrier around one of these massive boats. And then at 3 o'clock in the morning, before the captain walked up onto the bridge, we put in a phone call and said, hey, just before you press that ignition button, we need to let you know that we've essentially seized your boat. And in a lot of these events that we used to do with Greenpeace, you know, you have to really know about nonviolence, not only as a way of practicing it, but as a way of resisting some of the anger that we would encounter. But I thought it was highly effective because it drew attention to a problem that you just don't see on the nightly news. You don't really read about in the newspaper. But
and were you one of those people in the water?
I was one of those people in the water. Yeah.
But and, you weren't one of the divers. You were just
I was a little too young at the time to be one of the divers. But I was in the water and I could see the reaction that that we provoked
that reaction?
Well, it was mixed, which was fascinating. There were a lot of folks who were angry, but there were a lot of people who were able to overcome their anger, you know, a minute or two into the conversation. So they'd start and say, "What are you doing? Why are you here?" And then they would say, "Oh, all right, well," once they had a chance to listen about the impact that the company that they worked for were having, a common reaction was, "Look, I need to pay the rent. I need to feed my family. I need to pay the mortgage. But I don't want to be part of something that's destroying my future, my kids' future." And that's actually, that type of conversation I have all the time, even today, with folks working in the coal industry or people putting pipelines together. Most people, I think, really care about clean air, clean water, stable climate, even if they might be employed in one of those industries that's actually part of the problem. And so back at Greenpeace in the day, today with the Sierra Club, a lot of what we're trying to do is work hard on environmental issues, but really take care to be mindful of the impact on workers and communities as we make a transition.
And we're all entangled somehow in, or implicated somehow in this fossil fuel destruction that's going on.
Yeah. You know, so I'll put a blog out there, and there's always some folk, you know, people trolling around and saying, sending comments saying, "Oh, well, you know, you use paper, don't you? Or, you know, you have light bulbs in your house, don't you? Or you drive a car, don't you?" And yeah, of course, it's true. You know, we're all consuming resources. The point for most environmentalists, I would say, is not that we shouldn't consume resources, just that we should do it in a better way. We should be mindful of the impact that we're having and be aware that there are real solutions that are at hand that should be employed.
And also the response that you get on the blogs from people emailing or texting or Facebooking saying, you know, you're implicated too. That isn't to say that, you know, we shouldn't do anything because we're all guilty. I mean, that's right. Kind of, that's one implication that those people are doing. You know, you think you're so high and mighty, you know, you're burning up fossil fuels too, so who are you to talk? Well, if you take that to the logical extension, no one can talk and no one can do anything. So ExxonMobil and BP can then just go on doing their thing.
Right. So just throw up your hands. Why bother taking any kind of action or anyway?
And so that's totally immobilizing and dreadful for the planet too. So you were Greenpeace and then you went on to Rainforest Action.
Yeah. So I left Greenpeace 97 or so, started working for Rainforest Action Network. And my first job was to convince Home Depot to stop selling wood from ancient forests.
And you won that one, right?
We did, yeah. It was.
How'd you win that?
So it took us a couple years to convince Home Depot. And it's interesting because when we started the campaign, I actually had two targets. One was to convince Kinko's to stop selling wood from old growth or paper from old growth forests and Home Depot to stop selling wood. Kinko's, we wrote one letter, a single one-page letter saying, "Hey, you buy a lot of paper, comes from old growth forests. There's a crisis in that we're deforesting some of the most pristine forests around the world. You should stop. You should help us." And they responded by saying, "You're right. We'll do this differently."
One letter.
One letter.
Could have taken you 15 minutes. That's right. Incredible.
And then Home Depot, it took a couple years and hundreds of demonstrations, hanging banners from their corporate headquarters, doing ads in papers, working with celebrities. And eventually they moved forward. And it's been a big factor in helping to try to turn the tide in terms of old growth forest destruction.
I'm a little surprised that Sierra Club hired you to be executive director because you have such an activist background and they have a reputation, or did have a reputation anyways, kind of a start-year-old organization.
Yeah.
Was that a controversial hire?
Well, I was a little surprised they hired me too. I think there was maybe a very thin candidate pool at the time.
Oh,
you know?
Come on.
Having been at the club for a few years, what I have grown to love is that the grassroots of the Sierra Club is just like the grassroots of any strong environmental organization. You know, we've got members here in Wisconsin, all around the country, who are smart, sophisticated, hard-hitting, solutions-oriented. And so moving from RAN or from Greenpeace to the Sierra Club, it felt like I was part of the same culture.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Michael Bruin. He's executive director of the Sierra Club. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Well, let's get to the heart of the struggle right now, which is the XL pipeline controversy. Why is it such a big deal? Why are you so opposed to it?
Well, we're opposed to it because of the facts of the issue. You know, this pipeline would carry 830,000 barrels of oil every day from the tar sands in Canada all the way through the country. Most of it would be exported. And it would allow for the expansion of development in the tar sands, which is the dirtiest fuel source on the planet. Oil coming from the tar sands is almost 50% more carbon intensive than conventional oil. It is a massive source of toxic pollution for the First Nations communities living around it. It's having a huge impact on the landscape. An area the size of the state of Florida will be deforested, drained, and polluted. But also because this is a type of development, the symbolism of this pipeline is also important. This is the type of development we've got to move away from. You know, after years of record droughts, record wildfires, record storms, last year the lower 48 set a temperature record, a full degree Fahrenheit above the previous record. We can't stop. We can't continue to build out these fossil fuel developments the way we used to. So we've been putting a lot of resources into this, like many other groups, because it's such an important fight. And because one person gets to make the decision. That's the president.
What do you think your odds are in getting the president to not go along with us?
I think they're pretty good, to be honest with you. I know that there's a lot of pundits and prognosticators out there saying the president will approve it, but that's kind of how the punditocracy works. You know, it's the status quo assumption that the president will move forward. But I do believe the president is sincere in his commitment to want to fight climate change. He wouldn't have announced that it's a top priority in his second term. And it's really hard to say you're serious about fighting climate change and approving this pipeline at the same time. So I do think that we've got a fighting shot at it. Our opponents are well-financed. They're very powerful, but we're pretty powerful as well. And I think we've got a good shot.
And how do you apply pressure? And what can people do? What can the listener do who's listening in his car or at her office right now about this or in the next couple of days?
Well, so the first question, how do we apply pressure every single way we can, both in two parts of this? One is to highlight how important this issue is, how important climate change is, highlight the impacts of the pipeline itself. And the second thing is to highlight that we don't need it. We have reduced the amount of oil that we consume in the U.S. by 3 million barrels over the last couple of years. We have finalized regulations that will reduce our oil consumption by another 3 million barrels over the next few years. And so we are making great progress at starting to decarbonize the economy, particularly in terms of oil consumption. So the average listener, the first thing you have to do is talk to your senators in particular. Send them a note, send them an email, go visit their home office, text them, call them up late at night, and make sure that they are not approving this pipeline, not supporting the pipeline construction.
And you can do that easily. You can just go to senate.gov and find your senator, or you can call 202-224-3121. That's the Senate switchboard, and ask for your senator, and they'll put you right through.
Yeah, and there's lots of ways to engage. So you can write letters, make phone calls, as Matt was just saying. But also, I would say if you contribute to candidates, tell them you are not going to support any candidate that stands in support of this pipeline.
Is the Senate on record as being in favor of the pipeline at this point, or where is it? I mean, Obama's got the decision to make.
It's his alone. There have been more than a dozen attempts by the Senate to try to seize control over this issue or to try to force the president's hand. There are a bunch of senators, Democratic senators as well, who have been mildly in support of the pipeline. And so that's one of the reasons why the president's job is difficult, is that he doesn't yet have the support on both sides of the aisle that would make this an easy fight.
On the other hand, there have been a lot of protests around the White House. You were arrested there, as you said. There was one in October or November where Bill McKibben was speaking and a lot of other people too. And I know there's just a lot of grassroots opposition to this from a whole range of people. Native people, as you suggested, and environmentalists, and also I think ranchers don't want that pipeline to go through their ranches. And it's a huge rebellion against something that certainly the Republican Party and the oil and gas industry is just pushing, the business community is just pushing and pushing.
Yeah, you know, it's a massive movement of people that are opposed to this pipeline that isn't like what we normally see. I mean, the Sierra Club is working with the Tea Party in Texas.
Why is the Tea Party in Texas opposed to
it? Because the pipeline would go through a lot of farms and ranches down there, and these are folks who don't want their land seized for some dirty pipeline that, if it leaks, it'll be even more difficult. It'll be more toxic and more difficult to clean up than conventional oil. A lot of farmers throughout the Midwest are opposed to the pipeline. I think one of the reasons why there's opposition also is that many people, in addition to seeing the impacts of climate change, are starting to see clean energy begin to grow and be installed in real numbers. And so they understand that there's actually a choice here, that we can produce jobs, but we can do it in a way that helps the environment rather than harming it.
I was just driving from Wisconsin to Florida and back for a vacation with my wife, and we were amazed at all the wind farms we saw. Yeah. Wind farms in Illinois, wind farms in Tennessee, wind farms in Alabama even.
Right, yeah. Well, we've doubled the amount of clean energy installation in the last 4 years. We'll more than double it again in the next 4 years. And in a bunch of states now, what we're seeing is that wind, new wind, is coming online cheaper than coal or gas. It's cheaper than nuclear power by a great amount. In 2012, more wind and solar was added to the capacity in the United States than coal and gas and nukes combined.
It's really impressive. We sent an intern to do a story about Iowa, because Iowa is getting something like 25% of its energy from wind, leading all the states. And so I'm looking forward to getting that story in the Progressive. But it is an exciting possibility. And I know there are people like Harvey Wasserman's been fighting for solar energy since, 1970.
Right.
And that seems to be being affordable too.
Yeah. Well, first, thank the good Lord for Harvey Wasserman. He's been doing great work for so long. He's a good friend. But here's an interesting fact about clean energy. So you've got Iowa's at 25%. South Dakota's almost at 25%. The largest utility in Colorado will soon be at 30% solar plus wind. But what I find really fascinating is that, looking at wind in particular, 81% of all of the wind that's installed in the United States is located in red districts, Republican districts. So what we've been seeing is that most of the most visible effects of climate change are often felt, again, in red districts in the South, in the Midwest, with the drought of some of these wildfires in the Intermountain West. And a lot of the solutions to climate change are being located in Republican districts. And so right now we are in this awful situation where most of the Republican Party doesn't even acknowledge that climate change exists. But that will be increasingly an untenable position because it's their constituents are affected by climate and will benefit from the solutions to it. So there's hope there politically.
Sorry for interrupting. Michael Bruins, head of the Sierra Club. How do you react when you're in a debate and you do debates with right-wingers and the person on there just says there's no such thing as climate change or no such thing as human-induced climate change?
I take a deep breath. I try to have empathy for the person. And then, what do you do when you're at the dinner table and someone says that they believe in leprechauns or, they don't think that gravity exists? Like, it's hard to have a rational conversation with someone who believes in things that are, not true, at least on this planet. What I try to do is I look for what the values my opponent might have are and speak to those. So if I'm talking to some clown who doesn't think that climate change exists but believes in economic freedom, I say, well, why are you supporting these entrenched, dirty, corrupt industries when clean energy will put more people to work and will help our economy? So speak to what they care about.
That's a good strategy. You toured the Gulf after the BP oil spill. I wasn't able to get down there. What was that like?
It was rough. I spent a bunch of time down in the Gulf after the oil spill, and not only looking and touring around the marshes and wetlands that were affected there, but also speaking with and meeting with a lot of the fishermen and people who work in the tourism industry, particularly the Vietnamese community.
The shrimpers were just devastated.
They were, and an environmental disaster like that has impacts beyond the environment. So the impact of you know, hundreds or thousands of people being thrown out of work immediately, not being able to make mortgage or rent payments, the impact on family life. And I saw it firsthand. The house that I grew up in, we talked about the Jersey Shore before, was directly in the path of Superstorm Sandy last year.
Yeah, what was that like going back there?
Well, our house got flooded. My parents still haven't been able to move back 6 months after. Oh. And for miles, every single house had severe damage to it. And it really has a big social and cultural impact when this external event comes in and violently disrupts people's lives. What we're seeing is that is common now all across the U.S. Drought, fires, storms.
Storms of a century every 2 years.
Yeah, they're pretty frequent
these
days.
That's crazy, isn't
it? And it's not just sensationalism from the Weather Channel. This is these are real things happening to real people's lives.
Well, what do you tell people to do in their daily lives? People who recognize that, yeah, this, and more Americans, finally, I think the polls are turning around. Yeah. For a while there, the polls are going in the wrong direction, but I think more and more Americans understand that global warming is a serious problem and that it's a human-induced problem, and they want to do something about it.
Sure.
What do you tell them to do?
Well, the first thing I say, I remind them is that there is real reason for optimism. Because we've been able to have a great impact these over the last several years. Sierra Club has been able to stop, along with a bunch of allies, we've been able to stop 175 coal plants, new coal plants from being built. We've secured the retirement of more than 140 existing coal plants. We have an opportunity to make sure that those coal plants come down and solar and wind take their place rather than fracked natural gas. So I think it's important for people to have a clear picture of the dirty ways of the world and the scale of the challenge, but also to remember that we have the power as citizens to affect enormous positive change. And then to say that we can take change at a lot of levels as citizens, as consumers, as voters. It's important to use your full power as an individual to support those things that will contribute to a better society. So whether when you go to the grocery store, you go to the voting booth, or when you're talking with your friends and neighbors, we encourage people to fight dirty projects at every step, but also to advocate for positive solutions, solar, wind, energy efficiency at every step as well.
But what if they say, well, look, you know, I'm one person. I'm not one of the Koch brothers in their oil empire. I'm not ExxonMobil. You know, they've got kajillion dollars and all that power in Washington. And I'm one person who lives out in the boondocks.
Yeah, well, look, that one person has, working with lots of other individual people, we've been able to stop those coal plants. You know, individuals have been able to change how people think about gay marriage in this country, immigration rights in this country. We really do have an ability to affect great change, but it only happens when we work together and when we fight hard.
Well, that's going to have to be the last word, and I think it's a very wise last word that we all should take to heart, no matter what issue of across the progressive spectrum you're fighting on, whether it's women's rights or gay rights or the environmental movement, stopping global warming, stopping this pipeline. We all can do our part, and we need to do our part, and we can have fun doing it too. That's
right.
The thing you can do with fun people like Michael Bruhn, my guest this week, who's the executive director of the Sierra Club and author of a great book that I was looking at this morning, Coming Clean, Breaking America's Addiction to Oil and Coal. Michael Bruhn, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me, Matt. It's been great to meet you.
My pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.